Hi everyone, and welcome back to Not About the Weather. This is episode 12 of our little podcast that could, in which us motley gang of podcasting BFFs get together and talk about all the things that we currently love and don't love in our pop culture experience. This week we are doing a special episode about the new Harry Potter canon of 2016. So usually we come on and we talk about whatever we are feeling, you know, all sorts of topics that we're happy or not happy about. This week we're specifically focusing on aspects of the new things about the Potter Wizarding World that came back into our lives in 2016, specifically Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So I'm Natalie, just in case you've never listened to us before, and I'll be your leading host today. I'm also joined by Brittany and Donya, and so you can get in touch with us to talk about this subject or any other, because we literally talk about everything, on one of our many social media channels. We have a main website, natwpodcast.com. It's the easiest hub to find everything about this podcast and about another podcast that we do for Teen Wolf, which is going to be nothing to do with what you're hearing today. But we share a big hub with that because it's the same team, natwpodcast on Twitter, natwpodcast Facebook, Instagram, Gmail, all of that, natwpodcast. You can also go to notaboutheweatherpodcast.com. which you can also follow as a Tumblr account, and that is where you can find our episodes posted aside from iTunes and things like that. That's the actual archive site. So, as I mentioned, this is a Potter-themed episode, as it's a very big part of all of our lives, and we all had pretty unique experiences with it this year, as it was a pretty big year for that aspect of the fandom that will never die, apparently. So,
So true.
So, thank you guys for joining me today. Especially thank you to Brittany, who has committed to getting up very early to do this, a time that I probably would have not committed to. So, thank you for caring enough to do that. Right. Potter. So, we had Cursed Child, obviously the stage play, and we had Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the new film, you know, set in the 1920s about Newt Scamander. So just very quickly before we get into it, everyone, which of these were you sort of more looking forward to and why as Potter fans, or were you kind of not excited about it until it came back into your life or what? Because it was a lot of Potter, you know, a lot of J.K. Rowling new material and a lot of, you know, surrounding things that we've talked about on the show before. Like, we've talked about the issues with Ilva Mornay, you know, and all of her canon on the website, which was done as sort of promo for Fantastic Beasts. So, Brittany, what was your Potter, with all of this stuff happening this year? You're quite a Potter purist, in my opinion. You're very, very still have a lot of emotions about this fandom. So, which one were you kind of more into and or sort of more suspicious of, I guess?
I was definitely more into Fantastic Beasts, the lead into Fantastic Beasts, just because I kind of ignore J.K. Rowling a lot. So that helps with the excitement. So when the trailer came out for Fantastic Beasts, I cried as soon as you know, they started like separating, because the magic, like, I just felt like, oh my God, that's right. Like, this is the magic that I love and I like watching, and it's going to be new. And I know I'm going in blind because I'm like kind of closing off to like most of the stuff that's going on. And I mean, I was fully into reading up on all the controversy with Ilva Mornay and that, but beyond that, I tried to stay away as much as possible, and then, you know, went to see the movie, which I have a little bit of a gripe about later, so I'll talk about that. But the Cursed Child, I was excited because I think because I got tickets, but also very, very nervous. As soon as I got the ticket confirmation that they were purchased, I was like, I don't know if I want to see this, and I kind of have to book a flight to London now. So
you're like, oh, I've got to commit to this now.
Yeah. It was not even so much the committing of going, but like the commitment of, oh, I have to see this whole thing change, and I don't know if I'm going to like it, and it will this ruin it for me. So like, am I paying a boatload of money to ruin everything that I've grown up loving? Yeah, so that was terrifying, but I did reread the entire series before I went to go see it, and I went into a social media like blackout because I saw it 6 days after the script was released.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I completely blacked everything out, and the hypeable people saw it I think a week ahead of me, maybe 2 weeks ahead of me. So I didn't talk to anyone for Hypeable for 2 weeks.
We saw it June 7th and 9th.
Oh, yeah. Then you saw it 2 months before me.
I think that was staggered. Yeah. Like, there was people went over at different times.
Yeah. So there was a big group of us who saw the first preview. And then there was another smaller group, or like in ones and twos, saw it like staggered from that point, like through the previews. And then I think a couple of people saw it after the previews.
Yeah, still. I think I saw the third performance after opening night.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was that was actually a fun time for me personally, just because I didn't have to be on Twitter that much. And it just because it like let me be excited about it and, you know, go in not knowing, like, I didn't even want to hear if people liked it. Like, I didn't want to hear if like they were like, oh, it was fine, or yeah, I liked it. I didn't want anything. I wanted no hints whatsoever. So it was more exciting the closer we got to it, because it felt like, you know, a Potter build up, and like there was the whole keep the secrets campaign, and you know, like I got a pin, and it was it was really exciting. But yeah, definitely more excited for Fantastic Beasts and very skeptical of Cursed Child for sure.
Mm-hmm. Donya, how about you?
I was excited for neither. which was a really odd place for me to be in, because I was both, like, I wanted to see both, but at the same time, I was in this place of not feeling any urgency to do so. The reason that I ended up seeing Cursed Child on the first preview was mostly luck. And mostly because I live so close to London that it was really easy for me to meet up with people and go and watch it with them. So when a couple of the guys in Hyperball were like planning a big London trip to try and do like something closest to like the first performance of it, I was like, well, I might as well join in because I'll be seeing them. So my whole experience was centered around seeing people rather than being really excited and needing to see it. So for me, I don't know. I was always that person when a Harry Potter book came out, like I had to be there at the bookstore at midnight, and I had to have it in my hands, and I didn't go to sleep until I'd finished reading it. And so it was a really odd place for me to be in, where I was like, yeah, but I don't really feel like I have to see either of these things. So in comparison, I saw Cursed Child on its first preview performances, the first ones that they did, but I didn't see Fantastic Beasts until a good couple of weeks after it came out, because I just didn't feel the need to go. And unlike Brittany, I did read a lot of the content leading up to it, both things. And I did follow a lot of like the trailers and extra material around Fantastic Beasts. And I feel like the more that I consumed, the less I felt like I wanted to go and see it. And so mostly it was just a thing that I did rather than a thing that I really wanted to do. So it was a very, very odd experience for me, not feeling that excitement.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's definitely, for me, I had Fantastic Beasts, I never had any hype about it, because I think because it was movie only, and because to me the movies were always such a supplement, like, to the books, like, I was just like, I guess, like, okay, I guess we're gonna see how they've done this, and obviously there was no book of Fantastic Beasts to go off aside from the you know, slight personality injected into that, you know, little charity book that they wrote of Fantastic Beasts that Rowling wrote. But I didn't see Fantastic Beasts for like a month afterwards, and the only and I was not planning to care about Cursed Child. Like, it wasn't in my schedule to care about Cursed Child. It was only happening after the casting was announced. Like, for me, the excitement of Cursed Child, and when I was like, oh god, I've got to go and see this, was after the casting was announced, and not due to the Potter canon. It was because that someone I cared about so much was now going to be leading this huge, like, the biggest moment in theatre, and I was just like, oh, holy crap, like, I have, yeah, okay. So that was sort of my urgency. But yeah, I guess we'll talk about more. And it should go without saying that everyone on this show today has seen the play in person of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And we did actually want to get someone on that hadn't seen the play, that had read it, to sort of give the perspective of, like, if there was something negative or if there was something they were confused about, you know, what didn't translate from the book. So we unfortunately weren't able to get that to work with the timing that we're recording. So if you are one of those people and we're sort of sitting here talking about the play, please feel free to contact us and, you know, chat about, like, you know, the page to screen issues, or like what did or didn't come across, or what we've said, anything like that. Anyway, we will go into our actual hypes and gripes, our favourite and least favourite things about these Potter experiences. So does anyone have a particularly strong opinion about hypes or gripes first here? I think I'm kind of feeling hypes on this one. I'm kind of feeling hypes first.
Sure, I'm okay with doing hypes first.
Cool.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so, All right, Brittany, do you want to go first with your hype re Cursed Child or Fantastic Beasts or both?
Yeah, I can. I have a feeling I'll start with one of my hypes for Cursed Child, and then lead in, like, I'll make it short and then lead into the other one, because I have a feeling it's going to just snowball into a discussion that you and I have had numerous times already. We've been having it for so long. Yeah. But my first real hype about Cursed Child is that, like, actual magic that they were able to make happen on the stage. They could have said no words and just done magic the whole time, and I would have sat through two performances still. It was amazing. So some of my, I didn't even know how to hype this. I just was like, I'm gonna run through my favorite bits. So like, you know, there's like little magic, like they're moving suitcases and stuff, but like, I've seen probably 50 to 75 Broadway shows in my life. It takes a lot to surprise me. Every single thing that this show did surprised me, and it was incredible. The first thing that, like, I was like, I like grabbed my mom's arm was when Harry cleans his desk and all of the papers stack up. Couldn't handle it. I looked at her and I'm like, this is going to be a rough night for me. That's like 10 minutes into the play, you guys.
Yeah. Oh God, that bit as well. And he's just like, turns out I haven't, or whatever it was.
We're not there. We're not there yet, Nat. But I loved the Polyjuice potion, the way that they were able, you know, to switch out the bodies. I loved all of the writing all over the theater when they shut it off in what's her name's room, they find like, and they find like the secret message. I loved that it was written all over the theater. And then the swimming part I thought was so cool, and this is ridiculous, but I was sitting, like, you know, in the highest part of the theater. So you couldn't see really, like, any of the audience below besides the first, like, three rows of people. And so, and then it's the stage. And so, because I was sitting that high up when Voldemort comes at the end of the first play, and he, like, walks into the audience, which, first of all, freaked me out. but he was so far away that I was like, oh, thank God I'm not sitting down there. Like, you know, everything is so far. It's fine. Like, he's really far away. And then a freaking Dementor comes up into the balcony, and I was so terrified.
Yes.
I'm not coming back. I'm not coming back.
I was in the front of the Grand Circle, or was it the Dress Circle? It was one of them, but I was in, like, the front row of that, and literally when the Dementors came up, it was, like, right in front of my face, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, I was like, I'm safe up here. Nothing can happen to me. And then a Dementor flies into the balcony, and I'm like, nope, this isn't fun.
Oh, it's, yeah. The physicality, like, the, yeah, how they actually, it was so well done and so cinematic that there were times when I forgot that it was a stage show. So I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, of course, special effects, whatever. And then I'm like, no, they had to pull that off live. What the fuck just happened? Like,
yeah, because, like, that's the magic that I really wanted to focus on, because, like, it's so cool. Like, I mean, the only other like special effect thing that they did that I thought, well, the first time they did it was awesome. The, like, eighth time they did it, I was like, oh my God, okay, I get it. Was when they're time traveling, yeah, and, like, the, they make that whole thing. Stage, like, yeah. Move. I thought that was the first time that it happened. I was like, whoa. And then by, like, I'm like, oh my God, we're jumping time again.
The gripe then. That effect with the lighting, or however they did it, Leo was, like, trying to reverse engineer it the whole time. She was like, how did they do it? Like, yeah. Really, really obsessed. But, yeah.
But my biggest hype is, you know, just watching Harry Potter as an adult, because, you know, Jamie Parker, I know I said I went into, like, a social media blackout, but before I went into that blackout, there was the Keep the Secrets video that I watched, and there was the casting photos that came out. So I was on MuggleCast about it, like, talking about, like, the casting and stuff like that. And the moment that they showed Jamie Parker in rehearsal with the glasses, like, he's just in, like, a t-shirt and, like, you know, whatever. And I'm like, ah, okay, I can see, I guess I can kind of see it before this, like, you know, being aware of Jamie Parker as a person. I'm like, I guess he'll be Harry. Like, I don't want this to, A, ruin Harry Potter, and B, ruin Jamie Parker for me. So there's a lot of pressure on this role. And, like, Harry, the character Harry Potter, like, I didn't care that as much, because, like, he was never my favorite character. I know it's Harry Potter, but, you know, I like the side characters a lot more. So when I saw him in the glasses in that little, like, Keep the Secrets thing, I started crying. I was like, this is not good. He looks so good. He's going, everything started to come together in that moment. And then there are just these scenes that I don't know if I read them, I would, like, be like, oh, Harry, like, whatever, you know, I feel bad for your life. If I read them, I don't know if I would have had it, they would have had the same impact as watching Jamie Parker play them, because I was like, oh my God, I love dark Harry Potter, like, depressed adult Harry Potter. Like, it blew my mind. The scene where he, you know, is talking to Albus, and then the scene where he's talking to the other Albus in his office, and he's, like, losing. I was like, I didn't know that I could feel this way about the character Harry Potter. Like, it just blew my mind. And I loved Jamie Parker's Harry Potter. Like, he is, everyone's like, oh, no, Daniel Radcliffe. I'm like, no.
Jamie
Parker is the Harry Potter in my mind now, which is would have been helpful when I interviewed Danielle Radcliffe and was freaking out. But yeah, so I figured that would go right into Natalie's because, oh man, we've had many hours of conversation about Jamie Parker in general,
yeah,
and then also
I can't
Jamie.
Remember how much of this I've said like out loud. Like I can't remember how much of this is going to be repetitive that I've like gone onto a tangent on another podcast about or something because. Yeah, it's so, I can't believe this. Like, I can't believe that this has happened. Okay, first of all, I really like Daniel Radcliffe as a human being and as an actor in general. He's a fucking phenomenal stage actor. I've seen him in a couple of things, and I really him in other movies as well.
In a few things. He's great.
He's an incredible actor. He's fantastic. And if he had the capacity, to know what to do with Harry, like to be working with a full set of books that were finished and to like kind of have that kind of perspective and you know, not the perspective of like a child who didn't really know what he was doing or like to have gone through all his stuff that he went through and then come out the other side. Maybe he would have been like, you know, perfect as Harry at some point. But the movies are like whatever to me. Like I know some people are really like they really, it really ties into their experience of the books. I don't hate them. But I don't love them, and Harry, Dan is not my least favorite of the trio either. Emma as Hermione is not that I dislike her as a person at all; she's amazing, but I don't like her as Hermione.
God, not the only one.
I never liked it. I was just anyway. Well, doesn't matter. The casting of this show was just unbelievable. Just unbelievable, and I don't know if that's Rowling. I don't know if that's like just the theater actors freaking. Bring it, like, because, you know, Rowling was more involved in the casting of this than she was in the movies by, like, a lot. You know, her and, you know, the producers of the show. But everyone that they cast was a much, 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 much better aspect of the character than, I think, anything that came from the movies. Even if the character wasn't used well in the play, like, for example, Paul Thornley as Ron was amazing. Like, he is a perfect Ron. It's just that what they gave Ron in the play was kind of stupid, if you know what I mean. Like,
so,
but he was Ron. Like, he was amazing. Like, much, much, much more like what I feel in the book. And the only one I think that holds up for the movies is Tom Felton as Draco. And then the actors that played Draco in this, that I actually saw the understudy one night, and he was amazing as well, like, quite different from the guy that plays him the most of the time, is Alex, I forget what his name is, I'll pull up the cast list in a second. Tom Felton as Draco, but Rowling has admitted many times that Tom Felton as Draco is the one person who actually made her learn something about the character that she didn't feel already, if you know what I mean. Like, he's the one that she has said, like, not only portrayed the character, but gave her more ideas, you know, more depth to the character than what she was writing. So I'll always love that. But this play, every role was so well cast. Like, all of the existing characters were so well cast, even if what they were given was not great. Like, for example, Ginny, the girl who played Ginny, was incredible. Even though they gave her the stupidest costume in the world and made her incredibly frumpy, despite saying that she was a sports editor. I'm like, you do not look like a professional Quidditch player, but you are still a badass, if you know what I mean. Like, she was, like, there were little things that were not well done by the character necessarily in the script, but the casting itself was just, at the essence, so perfect. And I can't believe, like, how well it was done, and it's just, I was so impressed with that, and I love theatre actors so much. I love theatre so much, and just what is able to be put in, what they're capable of, what they do every night, you know, in a live performance, you know, whether it's like, you know, pulling out the same emotions every night and being able to make it real, or whether it's like doing physicality, like massive physicality, like some of the stuff, for example, that Brittany was talking about, the magic, this wasn't quite magic, but my favourite, like, kind of, like, theatre magic moment was a bit where they, the kids are apologist into Hermione and Harry, and then the real Hermione and Harry come through the door, so they have to hide inside Hermione's office. And so you get this moment of them getting pushed through the doors into, you know, they're getting pushed into Hermione's office, and then so you see them go through the door, and then like 2 seconds later you see them, you know, Jamie and Noma walk on the stage as Harry and Hermione instead of as Scorpius and Delphi, who were inside of them, and you kind of like you see it and your brain's like, oh yeah, okay, if that was a movie, whatever, like you, and then you realize no, they had to just drop through a trapdoor, run under the stage, like run full speed, come up on the other side, and just walk very calmly in, like they hadn't just run for their lives within this, about 3 seconds. And just what theatre actors put in to shows is so constantly amazing. It's such hard work. And this is one of the hardest working shows that I've ever seen. Like, it's like everything they pull off in this show is so, so big, and so much rides on it, both like emotionally, the expectations of the audience as well, because, you know, it's not like, oh, you're coming in to see this show, you know nothing about. Everyone's coming in, sitting there being like, you better fucking get this right, you better get this right. And they have that expectation riding on them from an audience every night. As I said, huge physicality, huge emotion, and everyone who played like an existing character was just so good that I just love the casting so much. But Jamie as Harry is just unbelievable. Like, this man is my favourite theatre actor of all time, basically. And I've seen him in 6 or 7 things in the past 10 years, and I love him very, very deeply. And when he got this, I was just like, oh my God, like, because I could just see how it was going to be, and it was exactly how I could see it. It ended up being exactly what I expected, but like even more, because I didn't know what the script was going to be like, and some of the scenes I didn't think they were going to lean into that PTSD aspect of Harry as much as the show did. I thought that was something that only kind of slightly, you know, more tuned in people, you know, like adult fans are kind of reading the books and going, oh yeah, that's definitely probably a thing for him, right? Like, you know, the people that go and write, you know, all this fan meta about the, you know, depth in the books, which is never really addressed. I did not think that the play was going to lean that hard into that aspect of Harry's character, and I'm so glad they did, and I'm so glad that it was him that got to play it, because he is so good at that. He's so good at anger. He's so good at, like, kind of that self-deprecation and righteousness and yeah, basically, like, it's saying a lot that, like, a long time ago, like, when I first saw him in things, I'm like, my God, like, my dream role for him one day is Henry V, like, the biggest Shakespeare, like, quote-unquote hero role. It's like, I say quote-unquote because it's, like, a super, super questionable role ethically, like, the way that he kind of uses people's loyalty to him. But it's a huge role, and I was like, he would be the best Henry V I've ever seen. Clearly some casting directors agreed with me, because he was cast as that role for the Globe Theatre several years later, and I saw it, and it was amazing, and I can't believe, and that's, like, the pinnacle role for a lot of people, like, that, and I can't believe that, like, he got something even bigger and more perfect for him than Henry V, and I would have never in a million years thought that it was, like, in the cards or anything like that, I just did not think that it was in any way a possibility. Or I thought that they were going to do more stunt casting for this. I thought that the roles would be more more celebrity cast, honestly, like for kind of like celebrity stage actors rather than just like good people. And yeah, I still can't believe it. But yeah, him especially, but the whole show, I was, it was really superbly cast, and that's one of the reasons that we'll talk about in the gripes, that it's a real shame that the experience of sort of seeing this story is limited to the play.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone back and I've read the books since seeing Cursed Child, so I reread the novels like after seeing it, and what I found when I started reading or rereading is that sometimes, like, once the films came out, I sometimes slipped into seeing the faces of the actors. But The Cursed Child, the one thing I will give it, like, wholeheartedly, is that it snapped me out of that really quickly, because now I'm very much seeing younger versions of the stage actors in my head when I'm reading now, which fits with my original like views of what the characters looked like. And so it's been a really interesting experience to go back and reread the novels again and look at it from like the perspective of seeing like younger versions of the stage actors rather than allowing myself to be influenced by the movies, even though for me the movie characters were like not, even when I was watching them, I'm like, this isn't what I ever imagined they would be like. So it's been interesting going backwards as well.
I still think that when I read, I still have a picture in my head, which is sort of my own fantasy, like my own mind building it.
Yeah. But
the way Jamie expresses himself as Harry, like the way he talks and the way he reacts is much closer to how I pictured Harry than what Dan ended up doing with it. Though I did like some of what he ended up doing in the last couple of movies, but yeah, it was, they did a good job. My other sort of hype for that is actually the getting to see the adult dynamic between Harry and Draco, because that was something left hanging at the end of the last book, and people always kind of suspected that it was like, okay, they'd be kind of like, they've come to terms clearly in those 19 years, and you know, Draco's not really a bad guy. He's just like in the middle of, you know, a bad circumstance, and it's sort of conditioning. And as time has passed, as a Harry Potter fan, I've become more and more interested in Draco. I never really was in the start, and I've become more and more interested. And now I'm just, like, given what's come to pass, which is that they are fully, like, by the end of this, like pals, basically, that they were kind of colleagues, and they're like, ugh. And, you know, reluctant allies and stuff. And in this, they're very much kind of like, Draco is that one friend that, like, oh, Harry and Draco are friends, but everyone's kind of annoyed that Harry and Draco are friends, like, particularly Ron. and I loved it. Like, I was just like, I never actually expected them to get that close. But I loved it, and I loved some of the aspects that were addressed. I loved that Draco, like, talked about being jealous of the trio in school. And I just think they're a really good match for each other. And it's like, I'm sure there's a 5 million Drowry shippers being like, duh, we've been saying it the whole time. I never saw it in the books. I don't, like, I understand that they're kind of like two sides of the same coin kind of thing, but I never really was like, oh yeah, they're really like that about each other. You know, like, yes, Draco clearly was obsessed with Harry out of jealousy and stuff like that, but the fact that they've come to this point now is going to make a reread of the books very interesting in terms of how Draco treated Harry during that time. And I love that they've ended up here. I know some people probably don't. Like, some people are like, no, they should be more enemies forever or whatever. And even the fact that, you know, Scorpius and Albus became friends was something highly suspected by the fandom from the moment that the book came out, that, you know, oh, they've both got these kids, worried about their legacies, going off to Hogwarts together, the same, like, it was very predictable. But I was very, very, very pleased with the Harry and Draco stuff, more than I ever thought I would be. So it's kind of nice to have that new thing, new dynamic to discover that I care about, I guess, in the original.
The other dynamic, going off the back of that, the other dynamic that I actually really liked was between Draco and Ginny. Like,
yes,
that also was really great. Like, yes, there are some really great conversations that the two of them have throughout the play. And I was like, this is incredible. I actually really love this. So, like, the Harry and Draco dynamic, and then the Ginny and Draco dynamic. And then sometimes, like, the three of them, and then Draco and the trio as well. Like, those dynamics, like, they worked so well. I actually just...
Draco and Hermione as well. It was really good.
I fell so much in love with Draco Malfoy and just the Malfoy family in this play, like, so much. They were, like, for me, that was, like, the thing that came out highest.
I just wish he looked less like his father. That, like, bugged me a little bit.
Oh, do you mean Draco and Lucius?
No, Draco. Draco and Lucius.
Yeah. You'd think he'd try and break away from
that. Like, I guess Yeah, like, I feel like maybe they did it on purpose, like, because, I mean, everyone else kind of, with the exception of, like, Hermione, although Hermione was so beautiful and brilliant, and oh my god, I loved her so, so much. But the, you know, the hair, I was like, why did we have, to do that? I mean, all right, I guess so. I guess it was to show the difference, like, it, to show history, like, you know, almost repeating itself with Scorpius. So, I don't know. I was like, oh, I felt like I was watching Lucius, whereas everyone else, I felt like I was watching their character. Where with Draco, for at least the beginning, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm just watching Lucius, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think that there certainly was something there, and it would be kind of cool if he decided to break away from that. But, oh my god, the Wizarding World, especially Purebloods, they're so freaking traditionalist that, like... Yeah, I like that they addressed the issues with him and his father, like, as well, that he was kind of, like, all very scornful of his father. But it's like, if you hate him so much, Draco, then, you know, cut your hair or something. But, anyway... Donya, that kind of leads into your cursed child hype.
Yes. So the one thing that's always really bugged me a little bit about just Harry Potter in general is this idea of, like, Slytherins being evil, full stop. Like, that's it. And that's just the way that it is. It's like a really narrow view of anyone who comes out of Slytherin house is evil. And it's always... driven me crazy. So the one thing that I absolutely loved about seeing Cursed Child in particular was being introduced to Scorpius Malfoy and him just being this sweet bundle of, like, sunshine, essentially, and he's also a Slytherin, and he was just wonderful. Like, I absolutely loved him throughout the entire play. Like, I just... adore him. He is, for me, one of the best things to come out of Cursed Child. I'm like, ride or die for Scorpius Malfoy. But was also really great for showing another side of the Slytherin house, because, like I said, people get very, very narrow-minded about what the Slytherin house stands for and who comes out of it, and just actually being able to see into Slytherin House and other characters within it, that was great for me, because, I mean, a lot of my friends and closest friends hilariously have they consider themselves Slytherins, which is kind of odd. I'm like a Hufflepuff surrounded by Slytherins, but I don't know, just that was the thing that I really, really, really loved, was just having this deeper understanding of what Slytherin House stands for and who they are, because there's always, like, this fine line between Gryffindor and Slytherin, I think, because they're very, very, very similar. Just their approaches to things are where the differentiators are. And so the fact that there's this huge love and, like, almost... adoration of, like, Gryffindor House as being the ideal and Slytherin House being, like, its foil. I love the idea of being able to look at this from a more nuanced perspective within, like, material that is considered canon, because even though in, like, meta from the fandom and fanfiction, there's been a lot more, like, digging into Slytherin House and looking at the nuance of it, in canon, there really hadn't been that much. So it was really nice to just finally get something that showed a different side to the house and being like, look, this is... there's no cut and dry kind of, this is the one evil house and you should hate them. So for me, that was one thing that I really, really loved about Cursed Child.
It's a bit of a hang-up, isn't it? This the house thing, though. Like, it's a bit of a, like... like, how much can it really define, you know, like, about someone? And, you know, there's a lot being said about, like, the cycle of that with Slytherin, about, like, oh, you know, people going bad, or, like, you know, turning,
you know, against it. And it's kind of like a vicious cycle in that, like, they're treated badly by the rest of society and, you know, expected to be, you know, have bad motivations. And then, you know, for some people that would possibly be, you know, end up with them sort of being mistreated, and it's sort of a cycle that feeds itself. But I don't, honestly don't think Rowling was thinking that deeply about it when she decided it. It was a little bit simplistic when she ended up creating it, and then she sort of dug something, dug a grave that was a bit too deep for her to fill in properly. But it is cute, like, that, you know, Scorpius especially, it's kind of like, if the house thing is that important, is that, you know, is he just there because he's a Malfoy and that's it, and that, like, for the majority of people it's kind of just not actually that much of a personal judgment. Because if Scorpius wasn't a Malfoy, I don't know if he would have been the kind of person that people would sort into, Slytherin. He's very kind of more, I guess what you'd say would be like Hufflepuffly. And, and I don't know, it's just, the sorting is weird. But Scorpius is very cute. He's a character that we haven't really seen in the Potter universe before, in that he's very, 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 like, nerdy. He's very demonstrative, and that's honestly, there hasn't been a character like him in the Potter universe. And so that was very cool to see. He felt very contemporary. Like, him and Albus felt very, like, of the time, like, millennial teens, which is interesting to see how, you know, I guess the world has changed or whatever. Yeah. Did you see it with Anthony Boyle, or did you have the understudy?
No, I had Anthony Boyle.
Brittany?
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I had Anthony Boyle.
Because I ended up seeing it twice by accident, in that we bought tickets and they didn't arrive, and then I panicked and bought tickets in, like, the returns, and then they did arrive. So I was sort of and we had the, it was a really bad, terrible time, honestly, in which the tickets accidentally got sent to Australia and then had to get shipped back to, like, while we were in England. It was a time.
Oh, my God.
It was really bad. It was really bad. But anyway, it was very, very lucky that I, like, jumped on and there were returns on sale, like, for the first hours in England, and I was just like, how is this possible? So I was able to grab some very, very, very last minute. But I had the understudy for Scorpius in my first performance, and their name is James Lelacheur, I don't know how to pronounce this. It's a French last name, I'm really sorry. Lelacheur. Anyway, that was the understudy Scorpius, and they are a non-binary trans actor, or a born male, but, yeah, non-binary actor who is playing a male character but is not identifying as a male in real life. And what I found interesting about that is that when James was playing Scorpius, the whole, like, Scorpius and Albus, like, codependent, is this a romance? Oh, my God, everyone thought it was a romance. With James, oh, my God, it's a romance. Like, they've talked about this in an interview as well, like, with a queer newspaper, being, like, really depends on the combination of, like, the actors, like, who's doing Albus and Scorpius. Sometimes it is much more like that, and sometimes it's not, and James was outright saying that, and that Scorpius, it just is, completely reads as queer and completely reads as romantic with Albus, at least one-sided, whereas then when I saw it with Anthony, after seeing James do it, I didn't feel it as strongly, because for me, Anthony Scorpius felt more like an Eton boy, like more like a young Boris Johnson or something, as opposed to a young queer as hell kid, basically. And so that was interesting that people got that from even Anthony's performance, because I really didn't after seeing James, if you know what I mean.
That is interesting.
Yeah, it's that interview was very, very interesting. But the difference in how they kind of played the character was also interesting to me to see. That was the only one that I saw. Oh, no, sorry, the Draco was different as well. The time when I saw Anthony had the understudy Draco, and the time when I saw James had the Alex Price's Draco. So there's a whole lot of, like,
different elements of, like, what the actual, not canon of the show, but, like, what you would get for the from the performance based on the actors, because there were definitely differences in implications of how things were played, not just with the shipping thing, like, in the actual script and stuff like that. So that was also an interesting aspect, but the character was still very, very sweet, and yeah, I know that he's a big favourite for a lot of people. Okay. Let's very, very quickly do anyone got a particular hype about Fantastic Beasts?
The costumes were pretty. I'm like, the costumes were very nice. That's I think that's probably as generous as I can be about it.
Oh wow, you did not like Fantastic Beasts that much.
No. I'll say this. If the tickets to go and see Fantastic Beasts hadn't been bought for me by another person, I probably would have walked out of the film.
Oh my god. Alright. We'll get into that in a second. My biggest hype, I was not particularly keen for Fantastic Beasts. I really, like, it wasn't that I did, like, was against it. I just was like, okay, whatever. And then the Johnny Depp thing happened and I was like, no, I really don't want to see it. But I did, it did see it. What I loved was actually Eddie Redmayne's performance. I like Eddie Redmayne at the best of times. I really do. But I really loved, he really sold it to me that he was a frickin' animal weirdo. Like, I know a lot of animal weirdos. I know a lot of people that run rescues. I know a lot of people who are like, their whole life is dedicated to caring for animals and stuff like that. And he sold it as a bleeding heart animal weirdo, so like crying at the drop of the hat because of his creatures and stuff like that. And the fact that he was like pulling that off, like when he was like acting to like a tennis ball and a stick, you know, because of all of the CGI that they had would have had to do, I appreciated Newt really feeling genuinely like one of those animal weirdos. So that was my favorite element of it. I thought that was very cute. Brittany?
I really liked Jacob a lot. I thought he was cute and adorable and so innocent. And I did like the creatures.
I'm gonna be, for me, the creatures didn't feel real. That was one of my biggest issues with the film. Like, I was watching it and there was nothing about them that made me think that they were actually real. And I don't know if that's because I've studied animation and stuff like that, so that it's very, very difficult for me sometimes when a film is very heavily dependent on CG to, like, get something across that it means that I can't see them as real, or if it was just because it actually wasn't that great. I'm, like, not entirely sure, because there were, like, moments where Newt is, like, interacting, particularly with the Thunderbird, where he's, like, the Thunderbird is rubbing up against, like, Newt's face and stuff like that, and I'm, like, looking at it and going, that's not real. It's not real. Mm. And it kept throwing me out of the movie, of me being, like, like you said, Nat, I, like, really, really got the emotion from Newt that, like, he was, like, bleeding heart about all of these creatures. Mm. But at the same time, it was so hard for me to connect the two together because the creatures just weren't real to me. So I was having a hard time feeling what Newt was feeling because I just was seeing them as, like, these creatures animated and not real. Like, it was... I was in this really difficult place with it because I was just disassociating the two things. It was so hard for me because I was just like there going, I want to feel for these creatures so much, but because they are so obviously not real, it just kept throwing me out of the moment whenever, like, I was getting close to being, like, emotionally attached to it.
I get you.
I was mildly disappointed by the Niffler because, mainly because I've had a weird, like, obsession with Nifflers since they were mentioned in the book, and I had a very specific mental image of it in my head, and this was not quite it, and I was just like, it's not my Niffler. It's not my Niffler. But anyway, never mind. Do we want to go into the actual gripes? Then.
I think we've already crossed that line.
Yeah, yeah. we've crossed the line with the gripes. Let's right, go. Donya,
did you want to sort of carry on with your point there? Or
sure, yeah. I mean, across both Cursed Child and Fantastic Beasts, the one thing that's really getting me and stopping me from being able to really engage with the material is the idea of J.K. Rowling's advocacy versus the actual representation that we get on screen. And I'm not saying that J.K. Rowling isn't a great advocate for a very many social and political issues. Like, she is very, very, very outspoken. She is a hugely influential person when it comes to issues with, like, British politics in particular and problems that we're having over here. Like, it is a huge thing, and she very much stands up for the rights and beliefs of, like, so many things. But when it comes to the actual representation that she then has the power to be a positive influence over in her own material, it doesn't add up to the things that she's preaching. So it feels like it's part-time advocacy, because she's saying it in one breath and then being like, well, her actual material can reach so many people, but she's not putting the time and effort into it, particularly with stuff like the Native American content when it came to pre-Fantastic Beasts and everything to do with that. There were Native American scholars and novelists and everything who were trying to speak to her to just tell her, like, you know, it's not all bad, but you have actually got some things historically and culturally wrong because you haven't read the right source material. Here, let us give you these resources. Let us, like, help you. We want to help because we love Harry Potter. And it's just been silence, like complete silence. And I think that's what speaks louder, because she's being an advocate on one hand, and then when it comes to what she's actually creating and putting out, it is the polar opposite of what she stands for, which is so difficult then to, like, get behind and support both Cursed Child and Fantastic Beasts, because it goes against what she's trying to preach. So it's this weird middle ground that you're in with this advocacy versus her representation. So, you know, with the actual historical aspects of the 1920s and what was going on, like, Fantastic Beasts was incredibly white when it came to, like, a lot of what was out there. And just the Native American stuff and Ilvermorny and all of that was, like, really odd and not great. And then, obviously, I know that she wasn't fully in charge of Cursed Child, and that that was a lot to do with, like, a collaboration. So it wasn't entirely just her content. She mostly just signed off on being like, yes, this is canon, this is fine, we'll go ahead and this will be the next part of the story. But, like, the whole thing with Scorpius and Albus and the kind of the queer reading of that, but them very much just putting in
the
no homo bit.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, they're going, you don't, like, and this is the thing when I've been speaking about it to people and they push back and they're like, but they're only X age, but they're this young. And I'm like, they're going, yeah, but you still feel things when you're that young. You may not completely understand them, but it doesn't invalidate those feelings that you have. It's very heteronormative to believe that just because they're that age, they can only be attracted and want to pursue romances with the opposite sex. Like, that, even at that age, for me, I was aware that I liked women, but I didn't understand what that meant. Like, I knew very much that I felt the same thing sometimes for boys and girls, but I just, in my head, also couldn't connect the fact that that meant that I was attracted to both. So it took a while to, like, understand that. But at that age, it doesn't necessarily mean that those two things need to be mutually exclusive. Like, you don't need to, like, specifically put in a love interest who, for, like, the one character, for Scorpius with Rose. Like, you don't need to add that in just to be like, yeah, but it's not gay, though. So don't worry. It's like, the two things can exist alongside each other. And their age doesn't come into it, because it, what people are, like, saying is that, oh, well, if they are attracted to each other, it's immediately sexual, and therefore, at that age, that's not, like, they shouldn't be promoting that. And it's like, well, no, it doesn't always have to be a sexual thing.
But how come that's okay for a girl?
Yeah, like, I know, that's a whole other thing. So it,
not to mention that they had Moaning Myrtle, like, writhing about on her podium, like, you know, talking about how much she wants to shag everyone, and talking about how girls and boys wanted to shag Cedric Diggory, where I was like, okay, we've got that at least, but, you know, like...
Yeah. So it's just, it's this really odd middle ground that I'm in, where I'm like, a lot of the time when J.K. Rowling is, like, pushing for equality and really going hard on being an advocate for, like, political issues in the UK, but not just the UK, worldwide now as well. Like, I'm there, I'm behind her, because a lot of what she's saying I agree with, but then is it so much for me to expect that that advocacy also crosses over into the material she's creating?
No, not at all. It's not too much to expect. And with Rowling, I think a lot of it is that she thinks that she's done it because she knows it in her head. And then, like, for example, like, you know, whether it's with race, whether it's with, I don't know, the Dumbledore thing, like, it's such a weird choice for her to have made, like, to have said that, and, like, you know, after the fact, and to think that it achieved anything. Though I very much read it in the final book, like, I was kind of like, and I know that a lot of people did, everyone, when they saw that stuff with Grindelwald, were like, is that what we think it is? And turns out, yes, yes, it was. But she thinks that because she's thought something in her head, that everyone knows it. And everyone knows that, of course, she's not racist, and of course this character's meant to be of colour, and of course this character's meant to be Jewish and, you know, Muslim and all of that kind of stuff. There's been several characters that she's like, yeah, totally, so-and-so's a Muslim, so-and-so's Jewish, so-and-so's black. And they're all things that she knows. She knows in canon, she knows in her heart that that's how she created the character. She knows she's included Jewish characters, she knows she's included, you know, black characters, she knows she's included, whatever, 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 whatever. But she doesn't specify it on the page. She just expects people to be, I don't know, psychic, or to be, like, assuming that she's doing, like, assuming that she's being diverse, you know, assuming that they're not just reading it all white or whatever. I remember her saying once that, like, for example, Dean Thomas, when they were casting the films, you know, they were just casting all these white kids, and she was like, no, 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 he's a black Londoner. Like, and they're like, Joe doesn't say that anywhere in the books. And she's like, yeah, but he...
No.
And I'm like... And it and then it does sort of later on, but we're talking about, like, in Philosopher's Stone. Apparently there was a line that described him and then was taken out, which, don't know what's going on there. But that's an example that she has spoken about, that they were casting, and she was like, no, 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 he's a black Londoner. Like, that's... He's very specific, like, you know, represents that, and he supports his football team, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay... But if it's not on the page, how do you expect people to know what you're talking about? Like, how do you expect people to psychically know your diversity exists?
Exactly. And this is the thing, is that it doesn't have to constantly be mentioned either. If you set it in their introduction or even as like part of natural conversation, even just once, that's then set and you read that through every other interaction. Like the thing with it is that you need to be explicit sometimes. And a lot of writers, for some reason, shy away from being explicit about the kind of person that they're, the kind of character that they're putting out there, because I don't know why. Like, if they have a specific skin color, sexuality, or race, and that is, like, integral to them, or like their sexuality or whatever, that's integral to that character and you need people to know that, let them know it. Because just because you know it doesn't mean that everyone else does. So a lot of the time you have to be explicit. Like, the one thing that drove me crazy as well, and this is like a film specific gripe as well, is that Lavender Brown was a black girl for all of the films except for the one where she became a main character, then she suddenly became white.
What?
Like, that... Did you not realize that?
Well, I always pictured her in the books as like a... I always pictured her in the books as a black girl. But I didn't realize they cast her as a, like... I didn't realize they cast her at all in the films until they cast her as that horrible, like...
No, she was in the films. And she was credited as well in the films.
Nonsense. That is the biggest pile of bullshit I've ever heard. Okay, that is crazy. That is crazy. Yeah. I know that they, like, swapped around some of the, like, you know, random students, like, you know, like, oh, so, you know, whoever's being played by, you know, Padma or whatever's being played by different people in different movies, but that is horrific. And no, I did not notice it. I just thought that she hadn't sort of been there until they ended up casting, you know, the girlfriend. That is crazy.
Yeah, so originally Lavender Brown in Prisoner of Azkaban was played by Jennifer Smith. And it was, like, a non-speaking role. Yeah. But she was in that and she was credited. Mm-hmm. Then she was recast in Half-Blood Prince and Deathly Hallows by Jessie Cave.
Yeah, and I love Jessie Cave. She's freaking legend. She's a really funny girl. But, oh my God, I had no idea that happened. That is crazy.
Yeah. It's,
I don't know. I feel like that the whole, like, you know, we're being vague thing, like, it used to happen, like, a lot. Like, it used to happen a lot when there was sort of more... like, more censorship and more, like, oh, we can't, like, outright say things because we're not allowed to, so we're just going to imply them, especially with sexuality. But we're not there now. Like, you don't have to censor... like, there's no things where you have to censor stuff for that kind of, you know, like, minorities, you know? We don't do that anymore. So anyone doing that now is doing... a personal value judgment, a worry that they won't be accepted. Maybe J.K. Rowling's just an optimist. Maybe she assumed that everyone would think the best, you know, rather than her, like, trying to hide, you know, her representation. She does seem pretty vague sometimes, but I just, you know, maybe she thought giving people certain names would just signify something, which obviously it did, like, for, like, the twins and stuff like that, but...
yeah. Oh, that was another thing that drove me crazy in Cursed Child, I will say, is the idea in this alternate universe that Ron got married, that suddenly because he was with it drives me crazy, because he was with her, that it, like, completely changed him. Like, that whole thing, like, I sat through it just being like, this isn't funny, and this isn't amusing, and this is actually really offensive.
That was a bit of a mess. Yes, it was indeed. I mean, just the idea that, like, jealousy had to be the thing that fueled, like, Ron and Hermione to be in love was kind of, like, dodgy.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, yeah, like, if we'd just gone to the dance as friends, we never would have had that spark to fall in love. Okay, that's healthy. Anyway.
I think that the point is quite clear. There's obviously another example in her past work is the coding of the issues that the werewolves have as being queer and then not actually being queer. Like, using the problems of social groups to, like, be a metaphor for the problems of the social groups in your own universe, while not including those social groups in your own universe, is an exploitative problem. And I don't think that she, like, has bad intentions, but it sure did happen. Anyway.
All right. And
Brittany, let's do it. Gripe, how are you feeling? Sorry, that was quite an intense conversation. Do you have anything to say?
No, I didn't know where to interject this because it's not as big of an issue, but it does feed off of what Danya was saying about, like, what J.K. Rowling promotes in her, like, public image and personal belief life versus what she puts on screen. And the first time, a major problem I had with Fantastic Beasts was when I first saw it. It was like a week before it came out. I went to the charity screening of it where J.K. Rowling and Eddie Redmayne had like a conversation beforehand.
Yeah.
And it was all about Lumos, and Lumos is great. She's doing great work. But it like really drove home the point of how horrible orphanages are. And if you listen to someone talk about that for 45 minutes with such great passion and care and attention to this issue, and then you watch Fantastic Beasts immediately following it, you can't not see it as a giant advertisement for Lumos.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah, okay.
It took away a lot of, like, it took me out of the movie a lot. I was like, oh, so this is, like, her way of just talking about Lumos. Like, she doesn't actually care about the characters. Like, I just got that feeling a lot watching the movie the first time. I saw it another time after that. But, yeah, it was, like, it was a weird juxtaposition. Like, I think I wish they did the talk after the screening. Mm. You know, maybe, like, it would have been a little bit different. But it was hard not to see that ingrained in every, like, scene within, like, you know, the witch hunts. And,
yeah,
it was very, very prominent and a little troublesome. Like, I was like, all right, beyond everything else, especially the Johnny Depp casting, I was like,
oh, man.
And, it, you know, it takes you, like, first of all, he looks horrible. Like, it's not even... Let's not even approach the huge issue with his casting. He just does not work in the role.
I don't understand why they felt the need to recast.
Is that either? Because for me, that you were spoiled for. You said you knew the big thing that you were spoiled for. That was
I knew that big thing going into it. That was the thing that I knew.
Yeah,
was that he was going to turn out to be Grindelwald. Like, that was the thing that I knew. But, like, the casting was fine. The original that original casting is fine. I was actually fairly, like, I knew going in, so I already knew that everything that he was doing was very sinister, but, like, just Graves through the whole thing was, like, really creepy on his own. Like, the whole manipulation and the grooming and
as well. It was kind of like you'd understand how it worked, whereas if you saw Johnny Depp in the street, you'd, like, walk away and be like, yeah, not going near that guy. And Grindelwald's meant to be, like... Like, sorry, but hot. Like, he's meant to be, like, this very enigmatic, like, I want to follow you, like, kind of very appealing guy who turns around and is a psychopathic fascist, you know? Like, and I don't know how old that they're meant to be at this point. If this is the 20s, like, I don't know if they're meant to be, you know, if him and Dumbledore would have been, like, in their 40s at this point or whatever, but... No thanks to Johnny Depp's Grindelwald. Just saying, no thanks.
Yeah,
for so many reasons.
Oh, was not feeling that at all. But yeah, that was a huge thing. But the other thing I want to talk about was, like, when you see, and I unfortunately have been one of those people who, like, I would hate me if I could only read Cursed Child, but it is something you I feel like you have to see, because the actual plot of Cursed Child is just so bad that you need the acting to distract you from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they're, like, Harry's storyline, I think, is great, but the rest of it is just, oh my god, it's so not good. It's not good, and I haven't read it because I got enough of a taste of how bad it was from actually watching it that I still have yet to crack the spine of the written play. But yeah, once we started time traveling so much and, you know, going back and bringing characters that did not need to come back, when Snape appeared, I was like, no, this end it now. End it now. I'm like, all right.
And you like Snape, don't you?
I was going to say, unpopular opinion of me versus the world is that I like Snape. I like his character. I like his story. He sucks, but I like that he sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want, when he came back, my mom was like, my mom, she's seen like two movies and that's about it. Like, she's lived with me, but she's like, you know, she dropped me off at the Wizarding World. That's how invested she is. She very graciously went to the studio tour with me, but let me go on my own. She's like, I'm just going to slow you down. You take the day and do your thing. So, yeah. And she flew to London with me to see this play. So, all right. Good job, Mom. But so when she knows that I like Snape a lot, and so when he came on stage, she was like, oh, look. And I was like, why is he there? She was like, not the reaction I was expecting. So, yeah, there was a lot to be desired in the actual plot of Cursed Child. But, you know, you focus on what you love, and the acting was phenomenal across the board. So that, I mean, I hate to say it, but that saved it for me. So that's why I feel like go ahead.
That's one of the things with the casting. I feel like the content on its own is very, very subpar. Like, it is not great. But the actors elevated it to something else. They took what was material that, had I just read the script, I don't think I would have feelings about it one way or the other. It would probably just be like, okay, cool, into the trash, bye. But they took it. I probably would have. But they took something that I probably wouldn't have, like, even thought twice about and elevated it to something else. And that is a testament to how strong the cast is. And it's also really frustrating because so many people aren't going to see it.
Yeah, it's just expecting it to lean on the script book.
Mm-hmm.
Not even like a prose version of the story where you're seeing inside the heads in the same way that we're seeing inside the head when the actor does it. The fact that they're like leaning on a script book with stage directions and with like, you know, flat out dialogue that's not going to come across the same way delivered, like, not even written, you know, in a way. The reason that the novels, you know, get more into your head is because you have that inner perspective as well, even though it's in third person. I don't know how they think that this is, like, in any way satisfying, or that this was going to come across well, like, to people, because the only bits that were good were the kitchen sink drama bits, like the bits that were not to do with the actual plot, the bits that were to do with the emotional arc tying back to the original series, you know, between whoever the characters it was, whether it was Albus and Harry or Harry and Draco or whatever. All of those bits that are like, oh my god, this is like so gripping about the emotional state of this character, oh my god, yes. This is exactly, you know, if it was just like a non-magical drama about the emotional state of the people that we'd sort of grown up loving, those bits were great. But even those bits, I've heard people say, like, just reading it flat on the page, it does not come across like as deeply as it would, you know, if someone's shouting or crying or pausing or what, you know, whatever it is that they're doing.
Well, that's exactly what I was getting at. And like when I was talking about Jimmy Parker, like if I had read those Harry scenes on the page, I would have been like, Harry, get over yourself, and like been just frustrated with it.
Yeah.
But watching it, I was like, oh my God, like this poor, poor man.
Yeah.
You know, it really, like Donnie was saying, it elevated subpar material. Yeah. Like it was, the plot was so convoluted and weird, and Voldemort did not need to have a love child. My God.
That plot, number one, what the fuck? But number two, I also really hated the implication that this girl was evil just because she was got Voldemort's child. That I understand that she'd been groomed that way, like, for a while, you know, by, like, but I don't, like, understand why they didn't give her a chance to reject that, if you know what I mean. Or, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The fact that the whole thing was meant to be about, like, oh, you know, not choosing who you are, you know, the stigma of being Harry's child or Draco's child, whatever. Whereas Delphi, no one for a second was like, hey, maybe this girl has free will. Like, you know, even Ginny, yeah. You know, like the bit where they're sitting at the church in the end, and Albus is like, oh my God, how could I have liked her? She's Voldemort's daughter. And Ginny's like, this is what they do. You know, and I'm like, screw you. Like, screw you, lady.
Yeah.
Ginny Weasley, I love you, but shut up. Because, like, how dare you say that about anyone, that it is inherently nature for them to be evil just because their parent chose to be evil because of their circumstances. That's not how genetics work. That's
no.
Terrible.
It would have been far more interesting to see her break away from that conditioning and grooming. Because, even recently I read a fascinating piece about a woman who was brought up in a incredibly Christian society who mm-hmm. was literally groomed and put into situations where she was made to basically, through politics and advocacy in that respect, make people believe that Christianity should take over American politics mm-hmm. and try and get people elected into positions to essentially endorse and put through in policy like this very far right Christian ideology. Like, she was brought up to do that, to fight for that. And she actually wrote a full like piece about how she managed to break away from that lifetime of conditioning and realize that the world wasn't like that.
Mm.
And the idea that, like, it's so incredibly offensive to me, this idea that because she was groomed like that, she can't escape it ever, because she was born of these two people, of Bellatrix and Voldemort, that, like, she can't escape that. That is her legacy. Like, that is so troubling to believe that you cannot change through learning and understanding and listening. Like, that is just saying inherently that's who you are and you can never get away from that. And that is so deeply troubling to me.
And no,
because that's not how it works.
Yeah, and no one said, oh, this is because she was raised this way. She was raised believing this. They were like, it's because she's Voldemort's daughter. Full stop.
Yeah.
Even though she'd never met him. And it's just like, I really did not feel comfortable with that. But anyway. Yeah. So the plot element of the actual time travel and the Voldemort love child, which is, ew. Can you imagine, like, next time you read Deathly Hallows, be like, wow, Voldemort and Bellatrix shagging it in the back of Malfoy Manor.
Stop it.
Like, ew. It's just, do you think he'd ever had sex before? Do you think that was his first time? I feel like it must have been.
Maybe like, as like the gross snake man.
Everyone's like, I'm
but like Tom
man.
Riddle was.
Yeah,
Tom
he
Riddle
was hot,
kind of
so.
Hot.
Oh, this is bad. Okay. So yeah, we do have the problem that the best elements, the thing that makes Harry Potter and the Cursed Child valuable as a piece of Harry Potter canon, is the element that you will not get unless you see it in person. and potentially, unless you see it with these actors, depending on, you know, I'm sure the rest of the casting, you know, when it goes overseas will be, hopefully be equally as good. But yeah, I think that that's a problem, like, especially if they're not going to put it in, you know, cinemas, like if they're not going to do a theatrical filming or something like that.
Yeah, that's another thing.
They're just shooting themselves in the foot. Like, they're making it look worse than it is, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I'm, like, I know it's coming to New York, which would be far easier for me to get to, but if it's, I don't think I'll see it again.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, a very good, like, bottled experience with that original cast, where, like, I don't think I need to see it again. I took away a lot from that performance that I'm nervous to see it again. And that is not, like, no casting has been announced, so, like, that's not a discredit to anyone who's going to take on these roles, but it was just really good to see those people in those roles, and I don't know if I want to switch it up. And that's coming from another, again, a place of, like, oh well, I saw the original cast, so I don't need to see it again. I mean, I saw the original cast of Hamilton. I still try to enter the lottery every damn day. Like, it's not, it's the material. The problem is, like, the material is so good in Hamilton, whereas the material here is not that great. So I don't, if I have a really great experience seeing a certain cast with it, mm-hmm. I want to keep that as pure as possible. Whereas, like, Hamilton, seeing the original cast was phenomenal. I thought it was mind-blowing. But I'll see it 100 more times if I could ever see it again. Mm. Like, that doesn't bother me at all.
Side note, yeah. I thought no one would... the original cast of Hamilton, we've spoken about before, I thought that the only really irreplaceable person was Daveed. But, oh my God, the fact that they've got James Monroe Iglehart to do Jefferson is going to
I cannot believe that is happening.
Oh my God, I was just like, oh, I was just God. Like, oh my God. That's the only show, Aladdin, I did not like Aladdin, but it's the only show I've seen that gave a standing ovation mid-show for
mid
him.
Mid-show. It was unbelievable.
As a friend like me. He was the genie, in Aladdin. God. Like, and he'd played it from the start of Aladdin till now, like over 1,000 performances. And every night, mid-show, standing ovation for that number, and I've never seen it in a Broadway show before. Apparently Amber Riley
I've seen a couple
right now for Dreamgirls in London, and I am telling you.
But, I am trying so hard to get tickets for that.
I was not able to do it. Anyway, I can't believe, like, I was like, oh, he's no one will ever be able to do it like Daveed. Like, and it won't be like Daveed, but I'm like, that is a performer that is the level that it needs to be for that role. I was just like, holy shit. And they must have been holding out for a while to get him, because they were just having, like cast members, like people who'd been the understudy to do it, and, like, not announcing a new permanent replacement for quite a while. And then it's clearly because they were waiting to get him. And I was just like, whoa, that is
fucking massive. That casting is oh, my God. I took off for a while, like, you know, not entering the Hamilton lottery and just like, oh, whatever, it's fine. I guess I don't need to see it again. And then that casting was announced. And I'm like, well, here we go again.
Yeah. And even a little while ago, he did some shows at 54 Below. And at that point, Lynn was being like, go see him at 54 Below. He's my favorite performer of all time. And I'm like, and now I'm like, oh, like, you knew at this point, you must have known that you had him as well. So, like, that was like,
yeah,
that must have been so. Anyway, what would a discussion between this group be without veering off into Hamilton? Sorry about that.
I will say, though, that I am curious to go back and see Cursed Child again, not because I really want to see it again, but because I want to see how it's changed from preview performances to, like, it officially being, like...
Oh, yeah, because I saw it after previews.
Yeah, so I saw it before previews. I would be really interested to see, like, how it's changed and how maybe the cast have settled into the roles, because that was the first time that when I saw it, it was the first time that they performed it ever to an audience. So
weird.
Yeah. So it would be really interesting to see how that's changed. So I am very casually entering, like, the lottery that they have, like on a Friday. But yeah. I'm not trying really hard for it because I'm like, it would be nice to see because I'm curious, but I'm not like going really hard on like being like, I have to see how it's changed. No, I would be curious to see how it has, but yeah. But then like Brittany said, I don't care who's in, well, I do kind of care who's in Hamilton, but I also don't care because the content is great. So I'm seeing the London performance when it comes over here, and I might be in Chicago at some point in the summer, which means that I might try and see the Chicago cast because I'd be interested to see. So like, and if I find myself in New York again, I would probably try and go and see it again in New York. So there is a huge difference in like my urgency with like repeatedly wanting to see it. And like, it's a different motivation for wanting to rewatch something. So my motivation for Cursed Child is purely like, I want to see how it's changed from previews. That's it. But I doubt that it's going to be changed much, but it would still be interesting to see.
I'm glad that I got to see it at Christmas and that my tickets did not end up stranded in Australia, and that because of that weird disaster, I got to see it twice. And so now I have Jamie's performance cemented in my head. So if I ever read it, like, if I read a script, I'll remember, like, how it was, if you know what I mean? Like, so I think that's sort of what I value about it. But I won't want to see anyone do it after seeing him do it, for sure. Like, it's not something that I enjoyed the content of enough to, like, see no matter what, you know? Like, and it was 100%, you know, driven by him. And that was, I don't know, it was a lot. My gripe about the new Potter canon was actually more about Fantastic Beasts, though the thing about Delphi was a huge one for Cursed Child. I hate that. They're about to do a very similar thing on Supernatural where, like, Lucifer in a human body impregnated a woman, so now there's this Nephilim, like this angel baby gonna be born, and they're like, it's evil because it's Lucifer's child, and I'm like, it's not, though.
But you don't know that.
Yeah, like, and I'm assuming that's going to be what, like, the plot, that they discover that it's not. But anyway, so I hated that. Cursed Child, a gripe. It's a real, not Cursed Child. Fantastic Beasts, it's a real gripe, because when I say gripe, I mean it's really petty, is that the movie, especially this one, but it happened in all of them, is that the way magic is displayed on screen in the movies is much more performative than I ever imagined it being in my head, if you know what I mean. It, like, they have things, the way that, like, for example, in the originals, the way that the howler, the, you know, the red envelope howlers talk like a mouth, as opposed to it just being an envelope with sound shouting out of it that you can't see, if you know what I mean. In this movie, you know, I think at one point, like, when Queenie sends, like, the napkins to the dinner table, they, like, fly over as little floating birds as opposed to just, like, flop, you know, they're on the table. And yes, it probably is a very personal signature touch, and that's kind of within her personality. But I don't like that just because it was a movie that they, you know, needed to do so much with the visuals of the magic as opposed to it just being, like, a practical, normal part of life, as opposed to, like, flouncy all the time with it. For some reason, this has always really bothered me, that it's felt over, that the world has felt unreal and unrealistic because of the magic being so overdone, or costumes, or different elements in my head that I imagine being very simple and very practical being, like, a lot more overdone and a lot more heightened than I thought was real. And I prefer worlds where, like, magical worlds where the magic is kind of incidental and normal, and to me Harry Potter is similar to that, but the movies aren't, if that makes sense. And it really stuck out in this one.
Yeah, I mean, I agree a lot with that. I think it's very theatrical, yeah. I guess, is just the sticking point. And it's like, in respect to how you would actually use something like magic in the real world, like, you wouldn't always be trying to make it, like, incredibly showy. There wouldn't be, like, this like obscene amount of showmanship to it all the time, because that would be exhausting. Like, you would, if you're using it to, like, elevate your day-to-day life, which it's like almost, it's just an extension of you, it's an extension of how you work as a person, it is just another part of you, it is a way for you to be able to do these day-to-day tasks that is different from other people. You would perform it, if you had magic, you would undoubtedly perform it in the way that you would do other mundane tasks.
The most, like, laziest way possible.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be your way of getting a shortcut to doing something. Like, you would take the shortest route to it. So the idea that you would, unless you were actually trying to impress someone, for whatever reason, you wouldn't put in this, like, ridiculous amount of showmanship into it.
To be fair, I think the bit that I actually mentioned and the bit that stuck out to me was Queenie, and it was when she was, like, they were having Newt and Jacob to dinner, and that's exactly what she would have been doing, because that's very, I think that's very realistic for the character, so possibly it's not that great for me to criticize that, but it was just an example of, like, the Howler is a better example of, like, that's way more overdone than I ever imagined it to be in my head, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe something people like about the movies. Like, Brittany, you mentioned that you like seeing the magic on screen. Like, do you disagree with me, or, like, is it other elements?
No, I do agree with you. I like, the, like, disapparating, like, you're not, like, flourishing your wand or anything. You're just sort of, like, you can do it mid-walk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that type of smooth magic is, like, really cool. I agree that that cooking scene, I think it was overdone for dramatic effect with Jacob, you know, like, to show, like, his awe and amazement, whereas, like, you know, like, even when Harry walks into the Weasley's house in the movies, like, you know, the pan is, like, scrubbing itself, and he's even, like, taken aback by that. So, like, but that's, like, that's fine, but that's how I imagine it always being, sort of, like, you know, things just sort of happen. Yeah, but then I'm taken back to, like, the first movie where Harry and, like, they're in class and they're learning how to, like, swish and flick, and, like, you know, that is very, like, elementary. Like, you know, I feel like in Fantastic Beasts they would have been a lot more advanced, especially if she was an Auror. Like, you know, her magic has to be a little more controlled than that.
Yeah, because this is a lot of adults, you know, obviously, rather than, you know, like, the within
children,
the school,
like,
so it's very different.
Yeah, they're not at school learning how to do it, so.
I did like the umbrella. I feel like that's something that they should have had in canon before at some point, you know, like, the magic umbrella.
I thought that was that was quite cool.
Yeah. But just, yeah, just, oh, just in general, but, oh my god, the other thing, I mean, aside from the whole issue with Credence, which it's just so huge that I can't, like, the plot of Fantastic Beasts was also incredibly dark. But one thing I will say about Fantastic Beasts, and I don't know whether it's a hype or a gripe, it was just the hugest thing for me, was that execution chamber, was the suicide execution chamber in the you know, the American Ministry for Magic or whatever it's called. Because holy crap, I have rarely seen something so dark in Harry Potter and in any movie that's aimed at an audience that also has, you know, younger children. And that was so messed up that was like a, you know, a licensed, you know, like a legal execution, and that the way that they did it was like by kind of coercing the person to, like, want to die. And then it, and the fact that added weight to the theory that the place that Sirius died at in the Department of Mysteries, the Veil Room, was also an execution chamber, because that's a theory that's been tossed around for quite a long time, because that room was meant to be like, have like auditorium style seats around it, and it's like, this crazy, like, whatever it is, like death, you know, we don't know what's on the other side, where he went. Presumably he just vanished into death. But if, the, you know, if Rowling says that the ministry in America has this, you know, execution chamber, then that adds a ton of weight to the British one also being one, and that makes it so much worse. So that was kind of both my most hated part and my favourite part of Fantastic Beasts. So it's like a hype gripe together.
Yeah. It was an interesting detail and terrifying.
Yeah, it was
as well.
It was crazy. Okay, does anyone have anything particularly strong they wanted to say about either the movie or the play before we go on to the little end parts of our show?
I feel like I've been talking about these for months and months and months, and I don't anticipate stopping talking about them. Maybe Fantastic Beasts, just because I'm like, meh. I will say, oh, this is actually something I will say, that I have zero, like, investment going forward in the Fantastic Beasts franchise.
The other five movies that's coming.
Yeah, I'm sort of just like, I'll see it when I see it. I'm not waiting for a trailer. I'm not waiting for a date to drop. I'm just like, it's going
and
to happen.
It's kind of one of those things where I'm also like, and if I don't ever see it, then I'm not going to be broken up about it.
Yeah, like, it's how I feel about the Divergent series. I still haven't seen a lot. And Hunger Games, to be honest. I haven't seen the last Hunger Games yet.
Not me either, actually.
I didn't see Mockingjay Part 2. And I like the Hunger Games.
I do too, but for
same.
But
after, yeah, like, Mockingjay Part 1, I was like, ugh, I gotta go back. And, like, then it was coming out, and I'm like, oh, it came out. I should go see this weekend. And then it's been, like, what, 2 years?
Literal same.
I kind of feel like when it shows up on Netflix, I'll probably watch it if it's already on Netflix, which it probably is, because the
other
ones,
like,
are on there.
And it's, like, the first thing that it's recommended. Like, I don't have to look for it.
Then I'll probably watch it. I'll probably go, I'm looking to kill time, I might as well. Like,
and
that's
like, and the next thing next to it is not 30 Rock, then yeah, I'll probably click it.
So the last couple, like, at the moment, my Netflix is basically, every time I go into it, it does two things right at the top of my Netflix right now. It's always like, hey, do you want to watch Voltron? Or, hey, do you want to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Mine,
and I'm like, yes, to both of those questions. Yes, can I watch them at the same time? Like,
Mine is Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Buffy and Angel.
Oh, sorry, go on.
Because mine's Buffy Angel because of Rewatchable.
Yeah.
We don't have Buffy and Angel on the Australian Netflix, which is incredibly annoying because it means I have to change my DVD. Like, I have them all on DVD, and I have to change it after every
episode. God, what are we living in 2001?
Well, it's so bad. I'm so glad that they kept Supernatural on there for, like, up until I finished catching up with it. And then, like, a couple of weeks after I finished, they took, like, literally Australian Netflix no longer has Supernatural. And I don't know why.
Oh, my God.
But mine was Supernatural and Brooklyn Nine-Nine for ages. And now it's Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, ?
Oh, good choice.
yeah, anyway, I don't know. Five Fantastic Beasts movies. Okay, I guess. I'm not sure where they're going to go there, if it's all going to be like, let's catch some animals, or if it's going to be like a human-based story that happens to have, you know, that's about Newt, so there's stuff in the background. Like, is it just going to be...
Or if Newt's even going to be in it.
Is it going to just be
like
Voldemort,
because there is also that discussion.
Johnny Depp, you know, like, making out, because I don't know about that. Not Voldemort, Dumbledore, that guy. Dumbledore and Johnny Depp.
I was
going to
say, Voldemort, making out.
There's a lot of lines blurred.
I think that I do think, in terms of the representation versus advocacy, I do think that if she's writing five screenplays with Dumbledore and Grindelwald at the center, and that she's already had her whole outing of Dumbledore that he was in love with Grindelwald, if this is not addressed on screen in the movies, and then she is a dick, basically. Like, so I'll just say it like that. Like, that, like, if she's that willing to make that canon in her head, but that she won't put it in the films, because they're for, I don't know why, because they're for children, ? I don't know.
I mean, that's they really... have, like, this giant suicide chamber,
yeah.
So, you know.
I'm like, if they can put that in, but they don't put the element of, like, hey, we used to have a romance, or, like, some sort of, like, very undeniable emotional connection that people would be like, oh, that's what that was. Because I will just be like, what the hell are you, what was the point of you? Like, what was the point of you saying that about Dumbledore? Like, at all? Like,
yeah, and here's my other thing as well, is that I don't necessarily need it to be reciprocated on Grindelwald's
part. No, not at all.
I don't need that. Like, but if even they kind of, even if she approaches it from the respect of Dumbledore was in love with him and Grindelwald manipulated that and used it against him for his own gain, like that, I can also be like, that would be a really, like, horrific thing to see, but it also happens. So, like, but it needs to be addressed. Like, at least Dumbledore's attraction and or love needs to be addressed explicitly. Like, if you're only comfortable saying it outside of, like, the physical canon that is there and is shown to everyone, because let's face it, not everyone reads her Twitter account follows Harry Potter. And not everyone is going to be reading every single news story
from an interview or catching something like that.
Exactly. So not everyone is, so not everyone knows.
No, they definitely don't.
So you cannot say that that is representation because you have not explicitly put it in your canon material. You've added it as an afterthought that not everyone is going to read. So you can't stand behind that as pure representation until you explicitly put it in your canon. Full stop. That's it. There's no debate over that. No, I'm sorry.
There's not. Anyway, cool. 5 movies with Johnny Depp. That's going to be great. I'm really mad about Johnny Depp because I really liked enjoying Johnny Depp, guys. I really liked it when Johnny Depp was someone who was a good thing that was in movies. And so I'm really mad that
I'm basically mad that they've cancelled Johnny Depp now.
I'm mad.
Johnny Depp is cancelled.
I used to enjoy Johnny Depp, and there have been lots of people who've done, like, unforgivable things that I'm like, fine, screw you, Johnny Depp, I am pissed that he has, I'm obviously more pissed that he's a shitty person, but on a smaller level, I'm pissed that he is ruined as an entertainment for me. Anyway, moving on. 2 truths and a lie about, let me do it about my Jamie Parker experience. let me do it about because Jamie Parker is a freaking, he is an incredibly strange guy. And I've met him several times. I'm very, very fond of him. But let me tell you 3 things that have happened with me and Jamie Parker. And 2 of them are going to be true, and 1 of them is going to be a lie. So give me a second.
Make them hard, because I feel like I know a lot.
I think you're probably going to know, actually, because I think I've told you some of them, but Donya might not.
I might not, because you have talked a lot about stuff with Jamie Parker, but I don't know if you've told me everything.
Oh, no. Brittany definitely knows at least 2 of these, but oh well. Okay, so I've got the 3. So, this is in chronological order. So, 1, I met Jamie Parker for the first time on the opening night of the History Boys when it came to Sydney, Australia in 2006. And I was incredibly nervous because I was incredibly, incredibly moved by the show that I had just seen, even though I didn't know any of the cast. And he found this very odd, because the only people that people ever cared about meeting in the show were Richard Griffiths and James Corden, because they were the only ones that had any level of fame at that point. And he basically pointed over to a bench where James Corden and Richard Griffiths were sitting on the street outside the Sydney Theatre Company with a gaggle of people about around them being like, yeah, that usually only happens to them. And I was like, just a quivering mess. 2, I met Jamie Parker after doing a very, very, very small role in the Globe Theatre in one of the Shakespeare plays as a small role before he did some of their bigger roles. And I told him to be careful hugging me because my jacket smelt weird because it had been on the floor of a crack den the previous night. And at the end of our conversation, he said, next time we hang out, I'll bring my crack pipe, due to me having been at a secret show of Pete Doherty from the Libertines, which was in a very questionable location. And number three, I met Jamie Parker right after seeing Cursed Child, actually in between two of the shows of Cursed Child, you know, between the matinee and afternoon. And he was very nice as he recognized me off Twitter. But when I made a casual reference to the fact that I had been basically stalking his career for 10 years, he started awkwardly singing From a Distance by Bette Midler at me to represent my stalking, not just reciting, full-on singing. One of those things is a lie.
They all plausibly sound like they be true.
I really love this man. He is very ridiculous.
Oh, man.
Would it help if I give my guess?
Now we need the Jeopardy music again. Not that yeah. I know the Jeopardy music. I'm Australian. I've never seen Jeopardy.
Oh, you gotta watch Jeopardy. It's so good.
I don't know. For some reason, I'm feeling like, because on the last episode, you kind of tricked me by, like, all three were technically true, but there was, like, a twist in one of them. And I'm feeling like the first one is the lie, maybe because you saw History Boys in London, not Australia.
I'm going with the second one because I think the lie is that he had a small role at Shakespeare's Globe.
Oh my god, you're both like picking holes in this so bad. okay, the first one is the lie, and it is a twist. Brittany, the second one is totally true. It was a really small role in, I think, one of the comedies, not As You Like It, something even more random than As You Like It. And he was literally in the company. Like, it was before he was getting their lead roles.
I'm really curious what the twist in the first one is then.
It wasn't him, it was Sam Barnett. The conversation was not with him, it was with Sam Barnett.
I've heard this story before.
I did not meet Jamie at the first show. I did see History Boys the first night, the premiere in Sydney. Again, not because I was like, oh my god, got to see this. It was like weirdly because we had a theatre subscription as a gift and we're like, yeah, this is what we're going to. And I was like, okay. And then it changed my life. And yeah, that conversation happened with Sam Barnett, and he was like, usually people are only excited to meet them, and that all happened, and I was like I was more starstruck than you have ever seen me, but it was with Sam, not with Jamie. I did not meet Jamie at the first show. So that was the lie. It was a twist.
There we go. So I was kind of right, but for the wrong reason.
He's bizarre. He's... Follow him on Twitter if you like. His Twitter username is Dick LaFenwick. He still hasn't changed it. I remember the day he got Twitter. I remember exactly where I was and where I was just like, hold the phone, Jamie Parker's got Twitter.
God, Matt.
Okay. I am a super fan. I'm fanish about him to a level that is not appropriate for his level of fame. And so I really have to try and like not be crazy. But anyway, moving on. Question of the day, hashtag ANA, ask not about the weather anything. We have one from Zach H. Official, who asked...
Oh, Zach H. Official.
Yeah, you know Zach H. Official. Well, he actually asked, like, have you read or seen it? I've done neither, because I didn't say that. I said, okay, everyone's seen it. But his main question was, this might be too late, but do you even accept Cursed Child as canon? So do like having seen it, do you accept that as the canon of what has happened to those characters in the books?
If I was allowed to pick and choose like moments, I would. But for the most part, I want to say, like, it's a fever dream.
Yeah.
But, like, I love Albus. I love Scorpius. I love where Harry and Draco are at. I love so much of it, but I think if you combine everything I like, every detail I loved about Cursed Child, it would be like 20 script pages and not like a noticeable dent in what was produced.
There's a lot about Cursed Child that I'm just like, I'm sorry, I can't read. I don't know what that says. Like,
oh my God.
Suddenly I can't read. I'm that gif.
Yeah. The big thing for me that I really, even, I mean, the Time Turner, the Voldemort and Bellatrix baby, all of that is just, but the fact that it all ended up back in Godric's Hollow on the night James and Lily killed, and the fact that Harry has now seen that, like the fact that he experienced that at the end, is something I don't know if I feel comfortable with being canon. Like, I don't know how I feel about him, like, going on his life from there, even though he seems to think that that's, like, freed him from Voldemort in some way. I'm like, I call bullshit on that. I think you would be in a mental institution. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's, and that wrecked me. Like, I was so upset by him going through that. But that was the big thing that I was like, I don't know how I feel that this is what's happened to you. Like, this is now, like, what your life is. So that I was not happy about. I don't know. Like, even though it was very well acted, like, and it made me feel extreme things, I was like, I really hate that that is canon. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Again, like, if you take it away from seeing it.
Yeah.
I probably would have been like, none of it. Absolutely none of it.
Yeah. But yeah, Harry's level of PTSD, like all the weird stuff about the Dursleys and stuff is, you know, and everything basically about it, like all of that is totally exactly what I felt like his life was and would have been like. So that I'm good with. I don't know. Now, last episode, Donya, you weren't here for this, in our 2016 year review. For some reason, it was decided that we're going to be doing haikus. We're going to have a haiku section every week. Ariana has written this one. I don't know why. I can't remember why we were doing haikus, Brittany. Do you remember?
I wish I did, because... it's a great idea, and we were really gung-ho about it, but I don't remember why. I think because we were recording at, like, 1:30 in the morning, too, yeah. So for me, at least, so I would have been gung-ho about anything at that point.
We decided that having a haiku segment was the best thing that a podcast could ever possibly do.
Yep.
So this is a feature of Not About the Weather is that every week we're going to have a special haiku about the contents of the episode. Ariana has written us one. Brittany, I would like you to read it.
Oh, of course you would. Friday night, Harry. Potter watches She's All That, wearing khaki shorts.
Okay.
And tight.
Riddle me this. That was a beautiful poem. From Ariana. One day we'll make a coffee table book of all of these or something, along with her rewatchable episode synopses.
Oh, my God. I would, like, buy that book. I want that so badly. So quickly.
I really wish we could publish her Avatar ones. They're so good. We'll make, like, a Tumblr blog that's, like, just those. And
yeah, I want a book of them. Like, I just want a book of them.
Yeah, so that is... that's what we're doing now. I'll try and remember better next time why we decided to do that, but that's what's happening. We're having haikus about the news of the day. Haikus of the day. That will be the name of the segment now until we think of a better one. Okay, so that's it. We're done. We're done with Harry Potter now for a while, at least. So yeah, until J.K. Rowling decides again that she, like, needs some... I don't know, attention or something, and decides to drop a whole nother lot of canon. And there are certainly more Harry Potter specific podcasts that talk about all of the Harry Potter stuff
you know, that comes out, Mugglecast being one of them, but we have just been talking behind the scenes for a very long time about the experience of seeing Cursed Child versus reading it, so we just wanted to kind of get that all out of the way so that we can stop talking about it, basically. So if you want to ask us a question to answer on air, if you want to be like a question of the day, or if you just have feedback about anything that we've said in a previous episode, you can send us an ask on notaboutthe.weatherpodcast.com or reach out at NATWpodcast on Twitter or Facebook. Also, if you've enjoyed these so far, you can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes so that we look legit and start getting bumped up in the podcast pages on iTunes so that we are easier to find, should that be a thing that you want to help make happen. You don't have to. It's fine. We won't threaten you like they do on Rewatchable. Or, that being said, we won't give you an awesome incentive either, so sorry. All right. Like, Karen ain't getting anyone pregnant on this show or anything like that. So.
Oh, my gosh.
What? Sorry, Karen. I'm really sorry about what we've done to you.
She's not sorry.
I've never been forced to make up these horrible things for Karen to do. I don't know who does that.
I can't even remember how or why it started. It just suddenly became a thing really, really quickly.
It's one of my favourite things in the world, to be honest, is the Karen iTunes incentives. Though we have stopped picking on her specifically so much, but it's still my
favorite. It's pretty much gone right back to Karen. Like, I think even weeks where she's not on, we're like,
Karen.
Karen's fine. Her name is already there. It's, yeah.
Karen, we love you.
I do so much. It's just really funny because you're so innocent, and so it's funny to hear you going, guys, in my head when that happens. Okay,
she's our cinnamon roll.
We're done with Harry Potter now. So thank you guys for helping that to happen. And give us a shout if you want to. Obviously this has been a themed episode specifically talking about something. If you have any ideas for a general pop culture topic that we could do a themed episode around in the future, we'd love to hear that. Otherwise, you know, we'll just carry on with our weekly or, you know, every 2 weeks, whatever it is that we do, and talk about our current feelings. Do either of you have a particularly strong feeling about a themed episode for the future? Just out of
curiosity. Yeah, Danya and I are totally taking over and doing a Star Trek themed episode when the series hits.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about it.
Don't even worry about it. We got it. Okay, cool.
You don't need to worry.
Okay, cool. I'm happy about that.
I
didn't even need a second to think.
Yeah. I would actually be really interested to do an episode centered around Yuri on Ice. And the cultural impact that it's had, both from the perspective of people who have maybe watched anime before and people who haven't and aren't as in tune with Japanese culture.
I have seen that everywhere, I don't know what it is.
I haven't watched it, Danya. I'm so stressed. It's Yuri on Ice.
It's good.
I know. It's in that kind of position where I feel like it can't be as good as everyone makes it out to be, but then I'll watch it and I'm like, holy shit, it's better than everyone's making it out to be. Because I was in figure skating fandom as well, back in the 2009-10 hype of it. Basically, Brittany, it is huge.
Oh, there is a huge figure skating fandom.
Oh my god, Johnny Weir pre-coming out Olympic drama. I don't even want to talk about it. But, Brittany, it's an anime, basically, about competitive figure skating, about this kid who was kind of a...
I know everything, because this one, I don't even know how I know everything, but, like, all of a sudden it started popping up on, like, my Twitter feed, where, like, people are, like, watching this on the subway and crying, and, like, it's a screenshot, and I'm like, what is this? And then all of a sudden it started to be appearing on my Tumblr feed, and I'm like, what
I think
is happening?
It's taken off with fandom very dramatically because it is a Hannibal situation. It is everyone going like, is that meant to be gay? Yes, it is gay. Like, if you know what I mean. Like,
no spoilers here, but it is like full, like, period, it is.
Apparently there is, just, you know, issues in Japan with censorship and, like, there's a whole bunch of stuff. It's certainly worth talking about at some other point. So that could definitely be a thing down the line if people are interested. I was surprised someone hasn't brought it up as their particular hype yet, but we haven't sort of done many regular episodes this year. So
I will probably be mentioning it at some point because I just finished, I think during the week, I was really sick this past week. Yeah. So, I alternated between watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, rewatching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Voltron, and Yuri on Ice. So I've now watched Yuri on Ice, like, start to finish about 3 times. And the thing with Yuri on Ice, it's 12 episodes long and they're about half an hour each. So it's really easy to, like, flip through. And it's the same with Voltron. It's about 13 episodes long and they're about half an hour each. So they're really easy to, like, just, if you're lying down, just to watch and enjoy. So yeah, it'll come up. I'll mention it as a hype at some point once I'm off my Voltron high.
That is an interesting concept to think about, a theme, because there are several people I know that, like, you know, I'm sure you as well, from anime fandom, who have a very different perspective of, like, how a lot of people are, like, okay, Brittany, you know how there's, like, shitloads of Hamilton fans who don't know anything about Broadway and they are Hamilton fans and they've made their own fandom and they do not understand Broadway culture?
Yes, well aware.
That's what's happening with Yuri on Ice and anime, basically. Not necessarily a bad thing, not that I'm necessarily trying to gatekeep and I don't know anime at all, but that is definitely a very good comparison to Yuri on Ice and anime in general. Like, so that all of these kids who come from fandom, like, oh, shipping, whatever, like, you know, have jumped onto this show because they're like, oh my god, confirmed gays in sports, yay, let's watch. And then go in with that in mind and they do not understand the bigger scope of anime and, like, what's allowed, what's not allowed, what something means, like, you know, and they're kind of, so it's kind of an odd perspective. So it's definitely something, you know, that would be worth, you know, exploring from a few perspectives and hyping and griping about. And I definitely know people on both sides of that divide. So, yes, yeah. Sonia, good plan.
I've actually got someone who runs a friend of mine, actually, who has started an anime website that looks at shows from a feminist perspective.
Mm.
And Yuri on Ice was one of her favorite animes, even particularly from, like, a feminist aspect of last year. Cool. So her website actually is great if it's something that, like, that's a whole other discussion debate thing that I have about, like, critique of content from other cultures and putting, like, our own
different standards.
On top of it. But her website is actually, because a lot of the people who are writing for it as well have either lived in Japan or have experienced Japan as a culture or actually do live there. So it's really interesting to see, like, the dual ideals. So the whole perspective of, like, what they're doing is incredible, but obviously considering, if you're familiar with anime fandom at all and, like, the backlash against feminism, particularly for what they're doing, they're getting a lot of pushback, but they're doing incredible stuff. But yeah, they've written a lot of content about Yuri on Ice as well, which has been great. So I just, it's a fascinating discussion to me that I would love to
do at one point. It's a bizarre cultural explosion for sure. Anyway, that will be a story for another day. So, yes, thank you guys for coming on. We will chat later. So have a good rest of your Sunday and hope everyone enjoyed this. And if Harry Potter's not your thing, we'll catch you next time. So bye-bye.
Bye.